Welcome to the Red Sneaker Writers Podcast. News, interviews, and writing tips for people who are serious about having a writing career and want some practical knowledge to help them achieve it. Your host is the nationally best-selling author of more than 50 books, William Bernhardt.
Hello, Red Sneaker Writers. This is episode 55, going out on October 5th, 2020. Boy, did I hear from you listeners last time around. You know, sometimes when I record these things in the little studio by myself, I wonder, am I just talking to myself? Is anybody really listening? Last time you proved that people are really listening on two different counts. One, I mentioned that I, of course, am doing small group writing retreats in the year ahead, and that for the first time in December, I scheduled a completely virtual one, an online Zoom writing retreat, if you will, wondering if anybody would be interested. Holy smokes, were you interested? The things have sold out now. To be fair, it's a small group writing retreat, but I think that this is proof of concept. There is apparently interest, particularly right now, when most people are still under lockdown, in continuing with their writing. I think many of you are still working hard, even during the lockdown, writing, generating good content. You want feedback, and this is a way to get it. I also saw at least one registration from a person so far away. There's no chance, probably, they would ever come to the retreat in person, but virtually, sure. So, this is for sure a go. December 9th through the 13th, small group writing retreat online, doing all the things I normally do at the retreat. I'm going to read your manuscripts before it starts. I'm going to edit your work every night. We're going to have feedback, critique, editing, discussions of topics, all of it tailored toward the small number of people, 10 or fewer, in the group. So, if this sounds like something that might interest you, go look at my website, williambernhardt.com, and think about signing up. And I'm not just hustling you when I say you might want to do that sooner rather than later, because it seems to be filling. But the other aspect of feedback that I got last time was as a result of the piece that I did on authors AI, this new artificial intelligence program designed to help authors. Man, were people interested in that. In fact, some people actually tried it out and then told me how it went. So this time in the news section, we're going to be talking even more about gizmos and programs and other tech things that might help you in your writing work. And the interview this time is with the incredible Stephen James. I bet many of you are familiar with him already as a result of his thriller series, The Bauer Files, or his other books, but you may also know him as a writing teacher. He's the author of, among other books, Story Trumps Structure. And since your host, me, is the guy whose first Red Sneaker book on writing was Story Structure, The Key to Successful Fiction, might be interesting to see how the two of us got along. We got along very well. We've known each other for a long time, but still a lot of really valuable writing nuggets in this interview, so you want to check that out. But first, the news. Like I already told you, the news this time around is going to focus on other tech software, AI things that might be of use to writers. But that works pretty well because actually there are a lot of new services that have been announced in the last couple weeks. I assume that once again, this is because the world's in lockdown. And when people can't go to class or they can't go to some conference, that they're looking for things that they can do at home that might improve their work. One such program just recently announced is Fictional. And just to be clear, that's spelled F-I-X-I-O-N-A-L. This is an editorial AI, meaning artificial intelligence service, that's been around for a little while. It's sort of a, you probably know what Grammarly is, that, you know, you post in some text and it corrects your grammar. Well, this is an even more powerful or advanced version of that. Grammarly can actually be taught. Fictional can be taught because it's an artificial intelligence program. It can learn how you like to edit your work. It can learn to make customized copy edits, like according to your direction, customized line edits to manuscripts. So this is being marketed as something of use to both authors and perhaps publishers or people who edit a lot of documents. See if the editor, which could be you, the Red Sneaker writer, red inks a manuscript once, and then you feed that information to the AI, and then it can be looking for the problems that you corrected forever in the more revised version of that manuscript or other manuscripts. And this allegedly, I haven't tried it myself, but according to its advertising material, this goes beyond just grammatical issues. It can tackle things like pet peeves, things you know you do over and over again. If you're me, when I'm editing, I always look for the word just, because I know I say just way too often. I don't try and edit in the first draft, and then I take out about a million of them in subsequent drafts. Or so, another word I use too much. You have problems like that? Things that are impeding originality of expression, which happens anytime you're reusing a word, the AI can learn to look for that. It can tell you if some passage of your writing is problematic, awkward, has some kind of problem. Fictional, allegedly, I don't say that like they've committed a criminal offense. I'm just saying I haven't used this myself. Fictional can create a style guide, which you can edit, add to and subtract from, and then it can apply the style guide to all your manuscripts. Another new program, similar, not exactly the same thing, is Plotter, and that is spelled Plotter, which got a lot of publicity in the past week or so. It calls itself, quote, the number one visual outlining and book planning software for writers. So it's basically a tool for organizing and outlining in a visually attractive way. Just to be clear, this is not where you're going to write your book. It's not like Scrivener. It's not a substitute word processing program. It's not even a place where you're going to put in detailed notes or search or, say, on the character arcs or anything like that. But it's a great place to outline. You can lay the whole book you're writing out in a chapter-by-chapter grid. You can follow particular characters or plot lines. Perhaps one of its most attractive features is that it allows you to create a timeline that you can follow. Now, for me, I'm a big fan of outlining. As you may know, there's a whole section in that story structure book I mentioned about outlining, but I'm so old school, I told you to do it on index cards. Okay, cut me a break. That was written in 2013. Plotter didn't exist. And I'm not entirely convinced that Plotter adds that much to the index cards, but it definitely looks cooler. If you're interested, go look at their website and look at some of the images. I mean, the outlines, the timelines, they're beautiful to look at. Will that make your book better? I don't know. But I do think there are many people who aren't outlining or who resist outlining, not so much because they don't think it would improve their work, but because it's boring and they don't want to do it. They'd rather plunge right into their book and start writing. The problem with that is then you get about 100 pages into it and you can't figure out what happens next and the book hits a roadblock it may not recover from. Outlining is your friend. And if having a little tech gizmo makes it more likely that you will employ this friend and outline, then great. Another program, Lately. This is an AI service that's designed to help you with marketing, specifically social media posts. As you're probably aware, social media marketing is a huge, huge factor in book marketing today, and not just by the self-published. Everyone, big publishers, small publishers alike, everybody is using social media. I also suspect it's fair to say that this is not most writers' favorite thing to do, since most writers are not that social, really, and would rather be writing their books or, you know, anything rather than posting on social media. Well, Lately is a program designed to help you do it and do it better and do it more efficiently. Basically, Lately does two things. It looks into your past social media content and makes a determination of what's working and what's not, what works best. And second, it looks at the content you feed it and then generates dozens of different social media posts based upon your content that you can then send out anywhere. So it takes your content, it takes its knowledge of what works for you and what doesn't, and gives you all of these social media, all this content. All you have to do is give it the URL where you want your content to go. It can even add hashtags or pictures or photos, whatever. As you probably know, social media typically gets more attention when there's an image. The trick for me here, I would think, is that you cannot be posting book commercials every day of the week. People will get tired of that quick. You need a blend of both in with the stuff that I do, either for myself or for the books we publish. You know, most of my social media posts are, go to Facebook and William Bernhardt, check it out. Most of them are going to be, you know, talking about my cat or what I cooked for dinner or the kids and I played this board game, you know, real life, talking about my life, which people seem to like. And then maybe once a week, something that's more overtly commercial, talking about my new book or talking about a writer conference coming up or something like that. So how well does Lately manage that blend? Again, I don't know. I haven't done it, but, and I don't think it's essential for anyone, but if it gets you started, if it gets you paying attention to social media when you haven't been, then it might be something worth looking at. That's Lately, L-A-T-E-L-Y. One more artificial intelligence service you might want to check out, and that's called Trinity Audio. This one's geared toward audiobooks. Basically, it allows you to use text-to-speech technology to produce your audiobooks in a very affordable way. As you may know, you can go to some place like ACX and find a narrator for your book, but they'll want to be paid one way or another, either up front or with a percentage of the royalties, 50% usually, or both. Well, this is a way of doing it less expensively. Is it as good? I don't know. Jane Friedman wrote in her newsletter this week that it's easy to listen to an entire book that's been produced using text-to-speech technology, although she acknowledges that it probably doesn't sound as good as what you would get from an actual human narrator. On the other hand, if you don't have a narrator, if you don't have a recording studio and you can't afford to spend a bunch of money producing it, this might be an alternative you want to look at. And I'll also remind you about Descript, a program that does similar things that I've talked about in the past. Here's the bottom line for all of this. None of this is a substitute for you exercising your creativity to generate books, outlines, social media posts, or audiobooks. These are things that are designed to help the human, but not replace the human. They can't, at least not yet, but it's possible that the implementation of some of these things might save you some time, might improve your efficiency or productivity, and that's worth doing. And I'll follow up on that in the next section on writing tips. Really, when I planned all this out, I thought, let's just combine news and writing tips, as one unit this time. And then One of my children said, no, people like the format. It's news and writing tips and the interview, and don't mess with it. So, okay, even though this is really just a continuation of the previous section, we'll call this the writing tips section, because here's the tip that I was about to give anyway. One, don't become dependent upon technology, but two, use technology if it helps, especially if it just helps you get going. I know that even though I'm not what most people would call young anymore, I was of the generation that was able to write their first novel on a word processor. Okay, that's not completely true. I did write a novel when I was in the sixth grade, and that was all longhand, and it was horrible. Although it does have a courtroom scene, isn't that bizarre? But I'm not even sure I knew what lawyers were, much less thought about being one, but it does. But the point is that, you know, I had this spiffy new, I think it was an Apple IIc, or and it was cool, and I wanted to play with it, so I investigated the word processor, and I had been writing all my whole life, but I think because I liked gadgets, that helped me sit down and do the hard part, which is making yourself sit in the chair and write and write and write every day. At that point, I was a young associate in a big law firm, so I had long work hours as it was, and was basically making myself get up even earlier every morning so I could write for a couple hours. And I do think the fact that I had this cool, spiffy little toy, the word processor, helped me do it. So, same thing with regard to all of these other programs. If they help you do the work, if they make it more fun, more attractive, more appealing, more likely to get done, then sure, check it out. I doubt you really need any of them. I don't think any of them do anything you can't do yourself. But if they plus you by getting the work done or making it more fun or perhaps draw your attention to things you might not have otherwise seen, then go for it. Just don't be dependent upon it. Don't think it's going to substitute your creative right side of the brain, because nothing changes that. Nothing can replace that. That is why you are a writer. My interview this time is with the acclaimed Stephen James, who I had the pleasure of, I've known him for a while. I met him first time at a Sikh conference near Cape Cod, and that's been, I'm going to say about 10 years now. It was a good conference, though, and I enjoyed talking to him, and we've bumped into one another many times since. He's probably best known for writing his thrillers, many of them in the Bowers Files series, but his more recently he's turned toward science fiction with a book called Synapse that's getting terrific reviews. He is also a first-rate writing teacher and mentor. So, nothing could... he has written several thrillers that are named for chess pieces, you know, the rook, the bishop, that's... And if you've read my book, The Game Master, you know how much that appeals to me. I love games, love all board games, but he's also a terrific teacher. I mentioned Story Trump's Structure, which I think is a very good book, even though it preaches something rather different from what I say in mind, but this is the arts, and there's room for differences of opinion, and Stephen knows what he's talking about. Here's what he had to say. Stephen, thanks for being on the podcast.
Hey, thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, here's our traditional first Red Sneaker Writer question. If you could give one piece of advice to an aspiring writer, to all aspiring writers, what would it be?
I would say it was some advice that was given to me many years ago, and that is, don't fall in love with your first draft. Okay. So very often we write something and we think, man, this is God's gift to the universe or whatever. And we write it, and then maybe it could be that it could be improved. So you might be best to set it aside for a bit, come back to it maybe in a week or even a couple of days later. And my guess is you'll look at it with fresh eyes and maybe, maybe find that it could be improved a bit.
Yeah. You know, I hear people say stuff like that and don't fall in love with your first draft. And I always think, who are these people who fall in love with the first drafts? I read my first drafts and think, when did you forget how to write? That's awful.
No, I totally hear you. You know, I go through a lot of drafts. I sometimes when I'm speaking at conferences, people will say, you know, how many drafts do you go through? And it often is quite a number. Mm-hmm. And so I'll read someone's work and I'll say, man, this is really good. Just one or two more dozen times through it and you'll be, you know, right on your way. And they look at me, their eyes huge. What? I say, no, seriously, it's really good. Just, you know, another 10 or 20 times through it. And it doesn't really help to go about that approach.
Yeah, I answered that question at a conference once, you know, how many drafts? I answered 12.5. But I mean, who counts? I just know it takes a long time. I'm editing one now and getting some feedback from readers and think every time, how did I miss that? That's so obvious. And I'm not even talking about typos. I just mean people whose names change and from chapter to chapter. Yeah. Do you have a system for avoiding that kind of thing?
You know, one of the things that I do that it may be a little unusual, but I found it to be super helpful is actually print out the book. And then I'll often go to a new location, maybe a coffee shop I don't typically write in, just get out of my basement mm-hmm. or my normal headspace. And then I start reading it through with a notebook next to me and try to read it through a reader's eyes. So I'm asking myself, what would I be hoping for, wondering about, worrying about, or expecting at this moment in the story? And then as questions come up, I'll jot them down in my notebook. But really, I'm trying to look at the story through the eyes of a reader. And mm-hmm. I find that I'm, for whatever reason, I'm able to do that pretty well. And so so as I read through it, very often I'm very critical of myself because I'll be like, readers don't care about this scene right now. Just get rid of, cut the whole scene. Whereas if I'm just looking at my computer screen working on it, very often I just don't notice those types of things. So I do often print it out and then take notes as I read through it and make changes that way.
You mentioned cutting scenes. I sometimes think this is the real sign that you've made it or that you're a truly, you know, professional person who knows how to write when you can cut a big scene without it ripping out a part of your soul.
I don't know if I've made it then, because that's rough. That's tough for me to do.
Think, no, the book is better now.
Yeah, no, that's, you know, I remember my second novel, The Rook. Mm-hmm. Boy, it's been about 13 years ago now, I guess, when I wrote that guy. But I was working on it. A deadline was approaching. It wasn't done. And I finally realized I needed to cut the first, you know, 50 pages out, maybe 15 or 20,000 words, whatever it was. But I knew it was about the first 50 pages. And I was just laying in bed and I said to my wife, I got to cut the first 50 pages out of this book. And she goes, I bet that's hard. I was like, you have no idea. But it was necessary. And I think, you know, I think as writers, we'll come to a spot where we're like, our gut tells us, this is not working, or you need to cut this scene. I think we need to listen to that sort of inner voice, the subconscious, the gut feeling, whatever you want to call it. Very often, if I ignore that, I just make more work for myself because down the line, I've got to cut it anyway.
I think you're right. At least 9 times out of 10, if not more, if I'm wondering, I wonder if that should be cut. It should be.
Probably should be, yeah.
Something's nagging. I may not have quite put my finger on it, but some subconscious voice has already figured it out. Stephen, I know you work with writers and people who want to write a lot. Are there things that come up a lot? What are the most frequent problems you see with people who are writing for the first time or on the journey?
I mean, personally, I feel like believability is one of the most important narrative, I guess, I think of them as narrative forces or narrative That's just the term that I've sort of come to use, is you have, you know, believability and escalation, tension, desire, dialogue, all of these things, you know, press in on the story. And for me, believability is actually one of the most vital ones. And I find sometimes when I'm reading the book of an aspiring author, I'm like, okay, so I might say, I don't really buy it. Like, I don't believe that this character would say this or do this or whatever. And so I really encourage them to build up believability. And the second thing that's a little unusual, but I've been noticing quite a bit in the last few years, is this idea that that your character has to change during the story. Now, most people are taught the character must change. And so I'll start reading this book, and the character, the main character, is just literally whiny or just complains about everything. They're just not someone I would want to spend time with. And I'll say, why did you make your main character someone so, you know, undesirable or whatever? And they'll inevitably say, well, it's because of his character arc, because at the end, he's not a jerk. Well, if readers think he's a jerk at the beginning, they're never going to get to the end when he's changed. And yeah. So it comes from this view that the character must change, which I don't agree with. Like, I don't think that that's necessary. Like, if you look at any series characters, say Sherlock Holmes, James Bond, Jack Reacher, whatever, they're not fundamentally different at the end of every story than they were at the beginning. In fact, we come back and back and back to those stories, not because the character is fundamentally different, but because he's fundamentally the same. And so different story theorists have different views about this. Some believe that a story is there to change a character. Some believe a story is there to reveal a character. And some believe a story is there to test a character. Mm-hmm. And I'm of the bent where I believe that it depends a little bit on where the main tension is. But I think it's a helpful question for authors, especially working maybe on their first book or second book, instead of asking themselves, how does my character change? Ask themselves, how is my character revealed? And very often that will allow them to step away from this idea of making a disagreeable main character protagonist early on with the expectation that they're going to become someone nice at the end or whatever. And they'll be able to deepen the character as at the beginning of the story as well.
Yeah. I sometimes tell people that, your character maybe should change, but that's not an excuse for throwing an unpleasant person that nobody wants to spend time with out there. There still has to be a reason we want to read his story.
That's true. We do. And, you know, so some people say, you know, your main character must be likable. Well, there's a lot of characters in different novels, books, movies, TV shows that I've really found fascinating, but not all that likable. But I always tell people, make them irresistible. Make them someone that the character, you know, can, or the reader can't turn away from. So the reader's reading them and like, man, I don't necessarily like everything about this character, but I can't stop reading about him.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to say, sometimes they're likable, you know, but very often they have some traits that maybe aren't as attractive. But creating characters, you know, main characters that have traits that readers will want to spend time with, I think is, you know, you asked about sort of things that I see in the work of aspiring authors, and that's one area where I think characterization is vital early on to create someone we want to spend time with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good point. Sherlock Holmes would probably be a really miserable guy at a dinner party, but in the context of a good mystery story, you can't resist him because he does what he does and he's so good at it. That's the irresistibleness that you're talking about. I think that's, you know, that gets around the problem of, does everybody have to be likable, sort of flawless? That's really,
yeah. Fun.
Let's talk about the believability issue that you mentioned. Now, you've written a lot of thrillers, so I'm guessing students and writers you've worked with do too. And it seems to me that every modern day thriller is what's a nice way to put it? Larger than life?
That's a good way to say it. You know, the higher the concept, or maybe the larger than life the story is, the more incredulous it can be, and the more unbelievable it can be. So the higher the stakes, typically, the lower the believability. So you really have to build up the believability, and to the point where readers are like, no, I totally believe this. Like, one example I always think of is Jurassic Park. I mean, what a great concept. It just blows me away every time I think about it. Taking dinosaur DNA, you know, and creating these dinosaurs, creating a park and having everything go wrong. I mean, there's just so many elements to a great thriller, you know, right in there. But Michael Crichton builds up the believability so that by the time we see, you know, the dinosaurs, we're like, well, of course there's dinosaurs today. You know, it's like, we're like, yeah. Obviously there are dinosaurs. And so, I mean, a couple of the things you can do to build up believability is one simple way is having an expert argue against the thing that you're trying to make believable. Now, this just sounds a little bit backwards. I mean, you'd think, well, shouldn't you have an expert argue for it? No, actually, if you have an expert argue against it, like you, let's say that your book is about how these telepathic people can cause someone to have a stroke, like from a distance, you know, halfway around the world, these telepaths can do this thing. And so that seems kind of unbelievable at first. So if you had a character say, no, that's impossible. Another one says, are you sure? Absolutely. I've studied, you know, human brain function for the last 40 years. It's absolutely impossible for anyone to affect, you know, and he goes on. And the more he goes on, the more readers are going, oh, no, it's not. It's totally possible. And so it's a simple, it's a simple technique. Having an expert argue against it makes it more believable.
You're letting that expert be the devil's advocate, which
yeah.
also might be the voice of some readers at first if you hadn't put that in. But since you've got a guy... answering the questions and hey.
Because in, you know, in stories, readers instinctively know that things are not what they appear to be. And I believe that when we come to stories, whether it's a thriller, mystery, suspense, contemporary fiction, whatever it is, we want to believe in that world of the story. Some people talk about the suspension of disbelief, and I totally get where they're coming from. I sort of think of it in the opposite terms. Instead of you're suspending disbelief, you're actually entering it with a lot of belief, and you want that to remain. So I think part of our job as novelists is not just to create, you know, compelling stories, but stories where readers, when they start reading it, they want to believe it, and we don't get in the way of that. So it's almost like we're stepping out of the way of their disbelief,
right,
and we're allowing them to continue on this journey that they want to take, or else they wouldn't have started reading a story.
Well, yeah, don't you think that? I mean, it helps to suspend the disbelief if people want to go there. You mentioned Jurassic Park. Let me tell you, if there were a Jurassic Park, I would be there. I don't care if they get out every single movie. I would be there. It's a very desirable fantasy.
Yeah, it's just a great, you know, high concept. And I just love how it's built up, you know, step by step, scientific fact by scientific fact. And I've done that with a couple of my books where you point out one scientific thing and then another and another and another. And then in my book, I just bring them all together so that it's not that there actually is this device that, you know, can conquer the world or whatever, but all the science is behind it. And all I've done is just weave together the little aspects of it in a way that readers hadn't thought of before.
Mm-hmm. Well, in your most recent book, Synapse, that's futuristic, right? It's got some science fictional elements. Does that make the believability harder?
Yeah, you know, that was interesting. For several years, I had this idea that I wanted to write kind of a science fiction thriller that takes place about 30 years in the future. And so this one takes place after what some people would call the singularity. So in this book, machines have free will, consciousness, and self-awareness. They just already have that. So my question when I wrote it was, you know, if a machine or a robot, whatever, has free will, what will he choose to believe? And how will those beliefs affect how he interacts with reality? And so instead of artificial intelligence, which has been, you know, explored in countless different movies and TV shows and novels and so on, the question here was artificial belief. And so I'd never seen anyone delve into artificial belief before. And so, just to set up the believability of the story, just at the beginning, I just say 30 years from now, and then we start immediately in with the story. And I think readers are like, okay, oh, there's robots, and they can think for themselves. All right, I can buy it, you know? Sure. So it was a ton of fun to write. So like you mentioned, it's different. Most of my other books have all been contemporary, you know, suspense thrillers and psychological novels and so on. And this one, launching into the future, had some problems, not problems in the story, but like some problems as far as societal issues and so on, where I'm like, where is this going to be in 30 years? It's hard to guess, but you do your best and then you let the story take you from there.
That's how it usually goes. Stephen, thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate the chance.
Wasn't that terrific? Thank you again, Stephen, for that fantastic interview. I want to get you back on this podcast again sometime soon. In closing, because so many of you have reached out in the past couple weeks to tell me that you enjoy the podcast and want to support it, let me suggest two ways that you can do exactly that. One, I do have a Patreon page, which I use to mentor writers. And if you would like to check that out, there is a special podcast supporter level. Won't cost you very much, but I very much appreciate the support. That's at patreon.com. Patreon is P-A-T-R-E-O-N. Then search for William Bernhardt and you'll find it. And the other, even simpler way to support the podcast is just leave a review wherever it is that you're getting podcasts, Apple, Google Play, whatever it is. Just leave a, I hope, nice review, because that not only makes me feel better, it increases the searchability. It makes it easier for people to find the podcast, okay? Until next time, keep writing. And remember, you cannot fail if you refuse to quit.